Hebrews chapter 12, and we're going to read the same verses we read this morning for the scripture reading and look through these and learn from them. Hebrews 12, verse 18. And I trust as I read these, they will be more meaningful to us after having looked at their original record from Exodus 20 earlier today. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and tempest and the sound of a trumpet and the voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them. For they would not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, and this is recorded in the book of Deuteronomy, I tremble with fear. But you, Christian, have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Two mountains in these verses form the 2 points for the sermon, and then we have 3 applications given to us directly by the author of Hebrews. Verse 25, see that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised. And at that time refers to the time of the old covenant, not necessarily the time of the giving of the law. These words coming from Haggai. At that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken, that is, things that have been made, in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, second, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And number 3, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. I am sure that most nearly all of us have had the experience of looking for a place to live, and we've looked at various pieces of real estate. Even if you're a child who hasn't had to find an apartment or a house, you perhaps have gone with your parents and you have noticed that mom and dad are looking at this house or this apartment, and they've got options, and you certainly have, all of us have had an opinion about where we wanted to live. I was thinking just a couple weeks ago how glad I am that our personal option A about where we wanted to live in Lake County didn't happen, and where we are now, option B, did. So much better on so many levels. And you have probably thought, okay, you know, we were looking here, we wanted to go over there, we had maybe 3 or 4 options. And what we're looking at here, if I can put it in rather common terms, though not irreverent, what we have in verses 18 through 24 is a discussion of 2 places of real estate. One of them is Mount Sinai, and one of them is Mount Zion. And one of them is past, and one of them is present and future. And obviously, many of you have been in Sunday school, you've been studying the book of Hebrews, and you know that Hebrews is all about good and better. Not bad and good, it's about good and better, because the things that are described in the book of Hebrews are God-ordained, the priesthood and Moses, etc., the sacrificial system. All these things are designed by God, set up by God, so they are intrinsically good, but Jesus Christ is the fulfillment, therefore Jesus is better. And we come to the same thing here tonight in Hebrews 12, verses 18 and following. Back then, it was Mount Sinai in verses 18 to 21. The first point tonight should be quick because we looked at it this morning. Verses 18 through 21 describe for us in summary what we looked at more expansively this morning, and in fact, what we looked at back at the beginning of June. Back then, it was Mount Sinai. Back then, God appeared to his people, gave the law at Mount Sinai, and everything that was wrapped up around that, the smoke, the lightning, the thunder, etc. A powerful scene. It's not a dark, evil scene, but it certainly is an ominous and imposing scene. Because our God, according to verse 29, is a consuming fire. He is powerful. He is mighty. He is authoritative. And so we get the idea that what we have in verses 18 through 21 is good and right, but it's ominous, and there is something better. And the contrast, in your mind's eye, probably has a picture, kind of a mountain in a far-off distance. Haywood and I watched Lord of the Rings recently, and so Mordor is the picture in my mind. This mountain off in the distance, fire, thunder, lightning, gloom, doom. Well, that's part of it. You got to take the negative connotation out. But you still have this place that is like the law. It's imposing. It's bigger than you. It's impossible. And then you come to verse 22. You have come to Mount Zion. You can almost hear the music change, really, can't you? You look at what is listed here. You've come to Mount Zion, to the city of God, to innumerable angels, to the assembly of the firstborn, to God, to spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, to the sprinkled blood that speaks better. And every bullet point, as it were, that the author of Hebrews brings out shows you that we have certainly gone from something good in the past to something better in the present. We've come to something better in the present because Jesus has come. We've come to something better in the present that God had planned all the way through. So let's think, let's ponder what these good things are that Mount Zion brings to us now, or Mount Zion represents for us now. I focused on the word to because that is how we make up the list. There are modifiers mixed in between, but it is in the word to the or to such and such that we find what this author is wanting us to know. We've come, first of all, to Mount Zion. This place, Mount Zion, is the name given to the rock or the mountain on which Jerusalem was built. Jerusalem is and was a city built on a mountain. It was a fortress of the Jebusites, and the walls originally were built around more of the the original part of the mountain, and you read about various valleys around Jerusalem. Those valleys are there because they were down the hill from what was called Mount Zion. And yet you and I recognize very quickly that this Mount Zion is not going to the literal physical Jerusalem, but this is a heavenly Jerusalem, as verse 22 makes very clear. It is the city of the living God. So we are going to some place that is spiritual. If you're taking notes tonight on the note sheet we provided for young people, we are going to a place that is, or we have a place that is spiritual. We have a place that is different from what verse 18 says, a place that can be touched. Or really, as it is, a place that could be touched, but should not be touched when it looks at Mount Sinai. No, we're looking at a place that cannot be touched, but in fact, in irony, we will someday go to as that heavenly Jerusalem comes down. We have the hope of being able to be exactly where God is because he will bring it down to us when he makes a new earth and a new heaven. And the new Jerusalem becomes the central focal point of that, as you read in Revelation 21 and 22. Mount Zion is about a heavenly place, a spiritual place. It is a city of the living God. What a wonderful phrase. It's not a village. It's not a town. It's not a big town. It's a city. Teeming with people. Teeming with an innumerable gathering of angels. It is a place that is not sparse, lightly populated, merely us four and no more. It is a place that is heavily populated. A place where not just angels are gathered, but there is this assembly of the firstborn, it says later on. when you add together the innumerable angels in festal gathering, and that in and of itself gives it a very festival-like atmosphere, a fair, something that is certainly far different from thunder and lightning. You see blue skies, you see colorful banners, you see happiness, you hear music. That's part of this city. It's not the urban core burned out by flight. It is certainly a place that is attractive and alive. And it has here, perhaps your version says, the church, the assembly, the ecclesia, this gathering of the community, the gathering of the city. These are the firstborn. How can you have multitudes of firstborn? Because every believer in Jesus Christ is a joint heir with Jesus, the firstborn. Society today seeks for equality. We'll never reach equality on this side of eternity. But on the other side of eternity, every believer is a joint heir with Christ. I don't know how all that works out in terms of rewards and 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold, etc. But we will be by nature the firstborn among many. He is the firstborn among many brethren, and we are joint heirs with him, so we are as well considered firstborn. What makes Mount Zion better is that the God who was unapproachable at Sinai is not simply approachable at Zion, but he is sought after at Zion. He's the focus. He's the desire. He's the goal. Even though he is the judge of all, he is sought after because he makes wrongs right. He meets out the right decision. I trust you desire God so much that whatever is here, as good as it may be, you thank God for saving your soul, because that means you get to be with him, as we sang tonight. To God. That's what Mount Zion means. That's what Jesus makes possible. Mount Zion means we get to be with, this is an interesting phrase, the spirits at the end of verse 23, the spirits of the righteous made perfect. This sets this city within the context of not the future, but most certainly of the present. Because in the future, there will not just be spirits of righteous made perfect, there will be bodies of the righteous made perfect, according to 1 Corinthians 15. What this is telling us is that right now, those who are absent from the body are present with the Lord, and their spirits are perfect. This is the present tense condition. And to be with God and to be free from sin, that sounds like a great place to be. And yet God will give more when he promises to resurrect our bodies and we enjoy an existence that is difficult for us to imagine even now. To be in flesh and to be perfect and to not deal with the tug and the temptations that go along with it. But for right now, we are spiritually joined. We are, as it were, in a spiritual communion, even with the spirits of the righteous made perfect. Have you ever wondered, as you sang some of those old hymns, what they were talking about? About us being united. The church is one foundation, I think, is one of those songs. Talking about being united with the church that is triumphant, the believers that have died and gone on before. We are together with them. I think what he's doing here in chapter 12 is referring back to chapter 11, where he talks about these heroes of the faith, and he's saying that these, verse 39, chapter 11, these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. There is a connection where we will all be perfected at the same time. We'll all be made whole at the same time, spirit, soul, and body, all united together in righteousness. Right now, we have this connection with them because we have a shared faith. Their spirits have been made perfect, and because their spirits have been made perfect, we have the hope that when we are absent from the body and present with the Lord, ours will be too. And Sinai couldn't do that, but Jesus could. Jesus could. And of course, we at Zion, we have come to Jesus, who's the mediator of a new covenant. Moses, the good mediator of an old covenant, the divinely selected mediator of the old covenant, who was faithful in all of God's management or house or economy, whichever word you want to use, according to the book of Hebrews. Moses was faithful in all that he did for 40 years, according to Hebrews, in mediating the old covenant. Jesus is better. Because he brings a covenant, an agreement, a deal, a bargain, a contract that doesn't condemn us, but gives us life. By his death and resurrection, by the sprinkling of his blood that's referred to next, there is a better word that is given to us. All of this, my friends, looks better than the sight of Sinai, as holy, righteous, and good as what God did at Sinai was. This looks better, and this, though unseen, is just as real for every believer right now. So what should be our response? See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. How could we refuse this? This is so good. This is so superior. This is much better. It says, "For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven." It's inexplicable how humanity time and time and time again does this. How is it that humanity hears from the very mouth of God and does its own thing? And so the reminder for you and for me comes back to this. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. You've seen this repeated in various ways if you've been in Sunday school in the book of Hebrews. Starting back there with that appeal in Hebrews 3. How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? The first application is, do not ignore God. Teens, children, do not ignore God. You've heard the message again and again and again. You hear it 5 days a week in school. You come to church on Sunday. The repetition is to aid your learning. The repetition is not to harden you, compact you, tamp down the soil of your heart so that nothing can get in. No, the repetition is to show you in various ways how valuable this God is. Don't ignore God. Adults, we are certainly no less susceptible to this. It's not the teens and the children who refused to pay attention and give heed to what God said in the book of Numbers when the spies went out from Kadesh Barnea, came back with the report. It wasn't the teen and children's problem that they couldn't go into the promised land. It was all those 20 years old and older who agreed with the 10 spies, figured that even though God had delivered them from the known superpower of the world, maybe he had gone a bit too far in promising them the promised land. How could you give up such a good deal? You could wander around in the wilderness. You could go back to Egypt and be a slave. Or you could go to the promised land and have a house that you didn't build and vineyards you didn't plant. And they took option Z. Yeah, God, I'm not real sure if you know what you're talking about on this one. And God gave them the wilderness. Adults, do not ignore God. See that you not refuse him who is speaking. Pay careful heed to the things which you have heard. I wonder if we are possible. I wonder if it is possible for us to be affected in some way, just like the Hebrews we looked at this morning were affected. I mean, they come to the mountain and they see all of this, and they are not ambivalent or apathetic. They just want God to stop talking to them. They are affected. They want Moses to deliver the message. They're not per se rejecting God. They just recognize that in the face of this God, they just need some distance. Are we affected by what God has to say to us? Over the last few months of the summer, as we have looked at God's commands, have we listened to him who is speaking from heaven? That is the Holy Spirit. Have we been changed over the course of 10, 12, 14 weeks? One way we can see if we are not refusing him who is speaking is to note the difference in our outlook in life, to note the difference in our desires, to note the difference in our behavior, because our desires are changed, because our mind has been renewed. Let us not ignore God. We move down to verse 28. It says, therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. As you look at the difference between Mount Sinai and Mount Zion, there is something of eternal value. There is the replacing of something that was good but temporary with something that is perfect and is eternal. And the therefore in verse 28 refers back to his argument in verses 26 and 27, which in essence says God is going to shake things up and that which is eternal will remain. And so the author of Hebrews tells us to be grateful for an unshakable kingdom. David was the first to rule on Mount Zion. Solomon ruled after him, and after that, the kingdom is divided. Generations after that, the Babylonians come in and they take over Mount Zion, and for hundreds of years, Mount Zion is ruled by Gentiles instead of the Jewish king that God had first set up there. But there is a Mount Zion that will never be ruled by anyone other than King Jesus. It is eternal. And though God will shake things up, this is what will remain. You know what the sifting process is. You put something into a sieve, you shake it up, and the good falls through, and that which you want to throw away is left there. When God shakes things up, that which is eternal will remain, and there is a kingdom. Are we grateful for that kingdom? You say, well, that kingdom's not here. And so the scriptures say to us that we walk by faith and not by sight. I can't see Mount Zion. I can't see the innumerable angels and festal gathering. That doesn't change the fact that they're real. God has said they exist. They are real. This present reality that is spiritual is just as real as the people sitting around you. And it is coming. Are you grateful for it? Or are you caught up in your own kingdom? Your own domain, your own castle, your own agenda? Are you caught up in the kingdom of someone else? Some other person, some other movement? Is there something that is distracting you away from the kingdom that will never be shaken, for it cannot be shaken? We are grateful for it because it is the object of our attention. It is the treasure of our heart. It is it is as sure as the sun that rises. And then finally, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Our last response to what we see in Mount Zion. And here is the motivation, not from fear, but the motivation from relationship. The motivation from possession. Jesus Christ has given this to us, is to offer God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. Reverence and awe are that right kind of fear. Yes, God has brought us near and allows us to come to Him. And Jesus says that His greatest love is shown to us in that He would die for friends. And so there is rightly an aspect where Jesus does call us friends, and we are so closely knit to Him that it can be described that way. And yet there is still a worship that must take place with reverence and awe. Within the context of the book of Hebrews, that worship means that there will not be sacrifices, because that would now be unacceptable worship because Jesus has come. You and I are not tempted to bring goats to church, so we don't have to be quite so focused on that application as the original readers would have thought it might be necessary to do in Jerusalem. We need to remember, I think, in our time period, even perhaps some of those things that we read this morning, that because of who God is as the one true God, because God is spirit, because He is the creator who is holy, we need to be careful and concerned that our worship is acceptable in terms of not worshiping Him as the heathen around us worship their gods, their deities, their religious systems, as they worship their venerable things, their valuable things to them. And so we would never treat God as celebrity. We would never treat God as something that's good for a time, but then we need to look for someone else. We would never treat God as a man who would somehow be impressed with our fawning over Him. Now, we make sure that our worship of God matches up with His character as He displays it to us in Scripture. And lest we think that this reverence and awe means that we are dour and somber and quiet, you can go back up to verses 22 through 24 and see that reverence and awe most certainly fit in entirely with joy. If nothing else, that phrase, the festal gathering of innumerable angels. It's a bit interesting that that phrase is generally speaking used of gatherings in the New Testament era that were quite celebratory and were not specifically linked to Judaism or Christianity. Not that there was pagan worship that goes on among the innumerable angels, but the word is a general one. It's not specific to Christianity, and it gives us a scene of extreme happiness. Nothing lewd, nothing inappropriate, but joy, festivity, gathering. And that fits in with acceptable worship, with reverence and awe. I think of three different types of worship that we as New Testament believers can and should ponder. There is private worship. There's the time that you and I trust, spend with our Bibles and with our God in prayer throughout the week. Is it 6 days, 7 days? Is it five, four? I don't know what it is for you. Less concerned about the number, I'm more concerned about the motivation and the heart. And a private worship that is acceptable with reverence and awe. You can be in awe of someone and be extremely happy about that. Do you, throughout the week, have a time where you are by yourself worshiping this God acceptably, reverently listening to what He has to say, in awe of what He shows Himself to be? I trust so. I encourage so. I urge so. Because the worship that is mentioned here is not simply a Sunday gathering. It's just generally service. It's not Sunday morning worship. Let us offer to God acceptable Sunday morning worship. Let us offer to God acceptable Sunday evening worship. It is let us offer to God acceptable worship, general, no time constraints, no strings attached in a chronology or the day of the week. And my friends, it is private worship that is part of that cycle that helps to feed the public worship, which helps to feed the private worship, which helps to feed the public worship, and so on. And if you take one of them out, we miss out as believers on who God is. Romans 12:1 says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is, in the King James, your reasonable service. In the ESV, it's translated, which is your spiritual worship. The word worship in Romans 12:1, or the word service in Romans 12:1, is the same as the word here, worship, in Hebrews 12:28. And this brings to my mind, and this teaches me, and teaches us, that life is worship. You wouldn't take Romans 12:1 and say that it only applies to the times you're within this building. You would look at Romans 12:1 and you would see that all of life is worship. So the work that you do tomorrow, whether it's paid or unpaid, whether it's in a home or in a factory or in a hospital or in a classroom, life is worship. Whether you are 6 or 16 or 66, if you're a believer, life is worship. To present ourselves to God is really just reasonable or spiritual worship. And this is what is meant when I say that God frees slaves to serve Him in worship and obedience. It's a full life aspect. And then, of course, our public worship should be acceptable. It should be reverential. It should express awe. It should express that which is accurately characterizing who God is. Mount Zion is most certainly the place to be, because that's where God is. Because of Jesus Christ, this is where we have come to. We don't see it, but we're supposed to live it. I trust that the description in verses 22, 23, and 24 changes how you and I think about the Christian life that we have. That's what the author of Hebrews meant to do. My friends, as we leave tonight, may we remember that not only are we in Mount Zion now, but we are in fact marching to that place as well. We are marching to a date when God brings Zion here, when it's all made right.